The following episode may contain inappropriate material. Listener discretion is advised.
It's Victor Dandridge, the hardest working man in comics, and you are listening to PVB Cast with John Orlando. Guys, I'm telling y'all it's the best thing on the entire interweb. Listen long, listen strong. John, it's all you, man.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to another installment of the PVD Cast. I am your humble host and your podcast purveyor, John Orlando, and welcome to episode number 255. Thank you for checking out this episode, and I hope all is well with you and your friends and your family, wherever you are listening to this podcast. I hope everything's going well for you. On this episode, I'm going to be joined by two guests, both of whom are filmmakers. Stacy Toy is a filmmaker and one of the driving forces behind 258 Studios. She is based in Scranton, Pennsylvania. And the other filmmaker is a gentleman by the name of Richard Bergen, who is out of Chicago, who has made his very first movie ever. It's a horror flick called Fang. And so both Stacy and Richard are going to talk about their projects, but you're also going to hear about maybe some personal obstacles that they both had to overcome to reach their goals. They are both really awe-inspiring tales of overcoming the odds. And so that's on tap for this episode. But before we get to it, I need to let you know that this episode is brought to you by the great sponsor, World's Greatest Comics. They're located at 5974 Westerville Road in Westerville, Ohio. And they have tons of comic books, toys, comic book supplies, collectibles, back issues, posters. Basically, they got it all for your comic book fandom. So stop on over to the store and say hi to Jeff and the other fine folks at World's Greatest Comics. Or you can check them out online at wgcomics.com. Or they're even on Facebook. Just look for at WG Comics. And no matter how you interact with them, whether in person or over the internet, please let them know that you heard about the store from me, right here on the PVD Cast. All right, with that being said, ladies and gentlemen, I'm going to throw it to a quick break. And on the other side of the break, I sit down with my two guests, Stacy Toy and Richard Bergen. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the PVD Cast. And this afternoon, I have with me on the line Stacy Toy, the Chief Operations Officer for 258 Studios. Stacy, how are you doing this afternoon?
I'm great. Thank you so much for having me on. I'm excited.
Yeah, I'm glad you can make it, and I'm glad that you're taking a little bit of time out of your schedule to chat with us, and I thank you very much for that. You're in Scranton, PA, so my question starting off, were you born and raised in Scranton, or were you born and raised somewhere else and then moved to Scranton?
Well, I was born in Scranton, because that's where the hospital was, but I was raised, outside of Scranton, about 15, 20 minutes outside of Scranton in the part of the Pocono Mountains. And I was raised on a farm, and, you know, we didn't have much, but we didn't, you know, want for anything. I mean, we had, you know, clean clothes and a meal at every table, but we also baled hay and had horses and the farm and the chickens and all that fun stuff growing up too.
Okay. So definitely that probably, would you say, instilled a good, strong work ethic within you?
Oh yeah, definitely did. I mean, you know, you have to feed the animals before you open your Christmas presents and you can't see the ocean till you're 16. So yeah, it's a hell of a work ethic.
Man, you know what? That sounds like such a bummer to have to feed the animals before you can open Christmas presents. My goodness.
Yeah, I know, man. It's a tight ship, you know, but we learned. It was fun, though. We enjoyed it.
as you became, you know, a teenager and you got into high school and whatnot, what was some of your interests? Were you always kind of interested in filmmaking and you know, being involved in journalism and all that? Or was that something that came a little bit later on?
I was always interested in journalism. I was extremely active in high school because, just as I had mentioned before, you know, my family didn't have a lot of money. So my parents always said, you know, if you want to go and see the world and do stuff, you have to figure out a different way how to do it. And that meant schools and organizations and stuff. So I, you know, was the state reporter for the Future Business Leaders of America. And I was on the state board for student council. And I was the varsity cheerleading captain. And I was in dance. And I was so involved in so many things. And that afforded me to go to visit places like California and Chicago. And I mean, I was all over the place because my school then paid for it because I was representing these organizations. So as a teenager, I guess that's where I learned my hustle because, you know, it's like that was the only, I wasn't going to date a rich boyfriend whose parents were going to just ship me off to Milan for Fashion Week because that didn't exist here in the farmlands of the Poconos. So until I could get out, I just had to figure out other ways because I wanted to see the world and see how everything worked. And so journalism was, I guess I've always just had a natural curiosity for things and for people. And I always wanted to give a voice to people who wouldn't have otherwise have been heard.
And that led you to going to Oxford University to study journalism. So how did Oxford end up on your radar? Like, just, you know, you mentioned you really, really hustled to try to get yourself noticed by a lot of different colleges. But, you know, with all due respect, going to a university in the States versus going overseas, that's kind of that's a whole nother level.
Oh, of course it is. So I started off, I went to Elizabethtown College, which is one of the top small rated private colleges on the East Coast. It's outside of Harrisburg in Pennsylvania. And so through them, they had a study abroad program that took you over to Oxford. And so I got into that. And then after I got into that, I also then applied for another program that I also got into directly after all of that happened. So that I got into on my own because I had been over there for the study abroad program.
And after you, real quickly, we're going to kind of jump ahead a little bit in the timeline, so to speak, of your life. You've received a lot of honors and done a lot of alumni work for Oxford University, correct?
Well, I've received one. It was March 2 years ago, I think 2017 or 2018. And they had a dinner at Parliament and they honored, some the distinguished alumni from Oxford. So it was really, really cool and exciting just because it's kind of like a full circle moment for me. You know, it's something we'll probably get into. But when I left Oxford, I was at the lowest point in my life, especially with addiction and depression and stuff like that. So to go back and be honored. And then this night I learned from President Waller. He told me that my college, First Manchester College, because there's like about 40 colleges that make up Oxford University in total. Harris Manchester was actually made to give people a second chance because that's why they accepted older adults as opposed to the other colleges that had, you know, more things needed in order to get into there.
Okay. Let's kind of deviate a little bit from my questions here, because you mentioned that you had some dependency issues when you left Oxford. If you don't mind me asking, how did that issue start? How did your dependency issues start?
Sure, of course. So when I was about 15 or 16, I was getting really bad ovarian cysts, and especially being very active, like in gymnastics and dance and cheerleading, I had a lower disc bulge in my back. So this is pre-opioid epidemic and pandemic of, you know, the last few years here in the States. So I was prescribed, you know, like Vicodin and Percocet and Lauricet and all of those things. It would just start off, obviously, just when I needed it. And then it just moved to starting on the weekends because it started to make me feel good. And then, honestly, the thing that ramped it up the most was 2 weeks into my freshman year of college, where I had just moved into Elizabethtown College, it was 9/11. And I was looking out of my dorm window and seeing the smokestacks at Three Mile Island, which is one of the proposed hits, which is a nuclear power plant. So I was scared that my parents couldn't come and get me. They closed all the highways down. I didn't have a car. We couldn't leave. And that was the moment that I realized that I wanted to go into journalism. But it was also the first time, like I said, I was out of my bubble being on the farm and having something that massive happen and literally looking at something that could kill me at any moment, you know, from my dorm room if a plane did hit it. And so I didn't want to feel. And painkillers helped me to not feel, but they also gave me energy. And so that's when I just dove headfirst into journalism and also into what would become, you know, a massive addiction down the line. So at Oxford, when I was leaving my last week of finals, I ran out of pills. My doctors would obviously normally send them over. And I got I was up to 70 to 100 Vicodin a day at that point in time. And I had valid prescriptions because I was getting them from, I mean, who wouldn't give me anything? I mean, I was going to the number one school in the world and I was on the dean's list and I'm not doing anything wrong. So I got all of that. And the last week I ran out. So it was the first time that I was like going through withdrawal and all of that kind of stuff. And I realized something the size of a pencil top eraser was controlling my life. And it was the scariest point in time. So I guess, you know, when I came back and was honored at Parliament, actually the end of this month, it'll be 17 years since then. So that I've been clean off of all of those pills and everything else. So figure if that was 2 years ago, so it was like 15 years later, it's like a full circle moment for me to be honored as a distinguished alumni after knowing that I left as, you know, something very undistinguished.
Yeah. I marvel at your story because I guess maybe I'm very ignorant of how addiction kind of works because I guess I would think, and again, you please by all means explain and educate me on this. If you're taking that many Vicodin, how are you productive? Like I assume that there was tolerance issues in there. I mean, just if you don't mind, could you just explain? I mean, that blows my mind.
Of course. I've done actually two DNA genetic testing things, one through UCLA and one through another program. It came up like morphine, hydrocodone, fentanyl, and it all came up like least reduced effect. Even caffeine, it said, while normal people can drink one cup of coffee, I have to drink 3 to 4 cups in order to feel the same. So yes, while it should have killed a horse, I also didn't start there. Like it took about 4 or 5 years every single day ramping up because you're trying to keep up with the day before and the day before and the day before, and you're just trying to keep going. And like I said, I used to be shy as a kid. I really, really was. And these gave me, you know, the ability to be who I am right now. I've had to retrain myself essentially to become the person I want to be naturally and without having to do that. But that took away my anxieties. It took away any fears. And I wasn't afraid to, you know, take risks and to do all these things. And that's when I started to get my greatest accomplishments and stuff. But, you know, I've learned over the last 17 years that you could do it on your own too, because I certainly have. It should have killed a normal person. But again, it's time and tolerance just builds up.
And I think your story is one that, you know, I have a friend who is very similar in the terms of he lost his brother in the same way, as it starts off as something that's a minor injury. And then unfortunately, sometimes, you know, you're taking the medicine to make you feel better. And then it just kind of snowballs out of effect or, you know, it has that snowball effect and it just kind of runs amok, if you will.
Yes. And then so to continue further on into my life, I ended up having 2 children and I got married. And my husband was in the military. He was in the Navy. When he came home after his time that he served, he had PTSD real bad and depression. And on Veterans Day in 2011, he passed away of an accidental heroin overdose. In the midst, I had to learn a lot of lessons here because I had to learn that I've now seen both sides of the coin. And I had to learn that you can't save everybody. and people have to want it. But I did want to still make something good come from something bad. So I found out the person who shot my husband up, because he wasn't a heroin addict. He'd never even really done it before. And that's why somebody else had to do it for him. And I met up with him, and I took him to lunch, and I said that, you know, at that, this other person was shooting about 50 plus bags a day of heroin himself at the time. I said, if you become the husband to your wife and the father to your two sons that my husband can no longer be, I'll help you. And let's get through this together. And I remember he looked back at me and said, you know, you're the one person who's supposed to hate me, but you're the only person willing to help me. And I'm like, yeah, because I know what it feels like to be like, you know, when I was at Oxford and I went to go ask for help, like all of a sudden I became the drug addict. So I was the biggest, I lost everything. Everything was taken away from me. And I was like a drug addict, a failure and a liability to all, like all of this stuff. And it was like, all I did was ask for help. And I just got, I got kicked, man. I got kicked while I was down. And it's like, I just wouldn't die. So it's like, once you get to a point like that, you're just like, you know what? If I get back up, everyone's fucked. You know what I mean?
And you know, that's something I got to be honest. I don't know if I would have the heart to do. You know what I mean? I mean, I have so much admiration.
It took a lot of soul searching. But you know, at the end of the day, he's now 9 years clean. He's also the only one left out of all of his friends alive, because all the other ones have died of addiction. He has his own company. He's got his family. And, you know, I've proven, you know, not only that the only thing more powerful than drugs and addiction and depression is love and forgiveness, but I proved that it sustains itself, because I wasn't here holding his hand up until about a month ago. I didn't see him for about 2 years before that. And I never gave him money or any of that. I gave him minutes on his cell phone so he could call his kids and he could call me if he needed someone to talk to, you know, and I'd take him out to eat and I'd pick him up and take him to work, because all I said is like, you know, you got to keep a job. You got to, everything I asked him to do, he did, because he was just looking for somebody that believed in him. And it only takes one person. It was my father who instilled in me this new positive attitude about, you know, perception and reaction. It's how you perceive things is how you react to it. And so if you perceive things differently and start to look at things a little bit differently, you're going to react a little bit differently too. You know, it's just a whole kind of chain reaction.
Do you fear that your sons may develop dependency issues?
Absolutely. I absolutely do. Because my husband obviously had issues in the past, and I obviously have an addictive personality too. But it's something that I'm also very, very open about to my children. My children, they know everything about me. They ask me questions all the time. They come to me and, you know, I hear them and I hear through other people that they actually just share my story instead of saying no. Like they'll actually tell their friends about, you know, what happened to me and how they lost their father to an overdose. And so they're not going to do it. So I hope that all of that stuff continues. I mean, they're 16 and 14. So far so good. And, you know, I just got to praise God and hope that it keeps going. But, you know, I'll never not be there for them, you know, in any situation at all. I know, like, even my oldest has dealt with some anxiety and a little bit of depression and different stuff going into high school. But he comes right to me, and he'll only talk to me about it, and he trusts me. And so I'm most proud of the fact that I have that relationship with my boys, because we've been the three amigos ever since, you know, their dad passed away. So for almost a decade now, it's just been the three of us.
Well, first of all, congratulations on, what'd you say, 13 years or 17 years sober? 17 years, correct? 17. Well,
Facebook. Oh, geez, no pictures.
Well, again, congratulations on 17 years sober. And again, tip of the hat. And honestly, it's such a great story that you are helping out somebody that many, many people, I don't know if they'd have the guts or the backbone or the compassion to do. That's amazing.
Well, I was also fully prepared to walk in there and have him tell me to go fuck myself too, which is totally fine. You got to be ready for anything. But I at least wanted to go to bed at night knowing I tried. And that's it. Like, that's all you can do sometimes.
Well, let's talk a little bit about your career in journalism. You spent many, many years in the news and journalism industry. In your opinion, is factual good journalism in jeopardy of becoming extinct in modern times?
Oh, I'm sorry. You still think it's around?
Touche.
Out of the news business, 5 years ago, actually last month, she came up on my Facebook timeline. I appreciate journalism, but there's just so much of it now because everyone has their own iPhone and anyone can start a YouTube channel. And even the corporations and the networks are all owned by bigger people and investors that are influences on their opinions and how they swayed. And obviously that changes when they change hands and different things. So there's a lot of behind the scenes stuff that I was able to kind of even just get a glimpse into and whatnot. So I would just say, look at all of it and, you know, take it with a grain of salt, but don't focus on the negative stuff because that's what everybody's been doing and nobody's smiling anymore. And ever since I stopped watching the news, I mean, my life's been great.
Well, you've also been involved in a lot of documentary projects. And I guess here's my other philosophical question. I've been told that there's often this theory that when a person decides to make a documentary, that automatically makes a bias towards one side or the other of a documentary. Do you agree with that statement?
No, because it's how you tell the story. And I can give you two examples. Well, I can give you one example because he is the producer that I worked with. I co-produced along. He's an Academy Award-winning documentary producer. His name is Robert May. He is also a relative of mine. But he did Kids for Cash, this documentary called Kids for Cash, about the corruption and the scandal that happened in the Poconos many years ago. And he told it from the judges' sides and from the kids and the families and the other sides. Now, you leave that not knowing what side you're even on, because you did hear from, you have now compassion for the judge, but you understand the kid side of things. And, you know, so I truly believe it's how you tell the story. I mean, the one that we did together, Open Arms Haiti, it's still available online. If you Google like openarmshaiti.com, it'll come up. It's a 10-minute documentary. That one was geared towards raising money for this Christian organization. They have an orphanage. They were building schools, all of these amazing things, and have a safe environment because all of these kids lost their parents during the earthquake. So we did this, and instead of us telling or having a narrator tell, both him and I decided, let's have the kids tell the story. So we picked the actual kids that were in the orphanage program at the time, and they're the ones that are actually telling you the story. And what they say, I mean, granted, of course, it was scripted just because it needed to make sense, but what they're saying is all them. So instead of people telling you what you need, I think a good documentary just leaves you with thinking about all sides and knowing, you know, that it came from, you know, the organic source, or like I said, I've always wanted to give a voice to people who wouldn't have otherwise have been heard. And so I want it to be their voice, not mine.
My next question, I'm sure, is one that you have received a lot. While doing my research, I found that you were working on a reality TV project with Matthew Knowles. So yep. I have to ask, did you ever meet Beyonce or Jay-Z?
No, I've never met Beyonce or Jay-Z. But, you know, I've obviously, because I worked, you know, with her father, Matthew, and his whole team there, Tanya Bird and, you know, Angela Ellerby, all those guys are all amazing. The documentary, it wasn't a documentary, it was a reality show for the E! Network. We were working with Bunham Murray. We were filming in Orlando during Gay Days, and they were performing, and they were causing all this drama behind the scenes and all that stuff. So, I mean, it was a fun and awesome experience. I heard that it may or may not come back out because I know the girls just came out with a new album, but the girls look identical to Destiny's Child, I will say. Amazing girls. Love them. They're the three of them are the best. But yeah, it's uncanny.
How many times have you been asked that question? probably hundreds.
That's okay. You know, like I'm not one of, well, to be, I've been at the Grammys. I've been like very close to her because I go to the Grammys on the red carpet for the last 7 years. So I've been standing almost next to her, if that counts for anything.
Well, let's talk about 258 Studios. What was the catalyst for becoming involved with 258 Studios?
My business partner, Mark Zenenbaum Jr., he is the one who told me that I was a producer, and I told him he was crazy because I only knew TV producing, which when I was a TV news director for live TV news for 11 years, and I didn't know that it's different from film producing. So Mark actually hired me on my first Toyota commercial that we did, and it ended up being a Super Bowl commercial, and I was like, oh my God, I am a producer. And so, you know, we just really, you know, we'd been friends for a few years and stuff, but this was the first time we'd worked together, and we decided to join forces. And so I produced all of his stuff there. And, since the last 5 years we've been together, we've now have affiliate offices in LA, Atlanta, Orlando, and London too, as well as here in Scranton.
Well, what's some of the projects that 258 Studios have on tap? Can you talk about those or? Well, are they still top secret?
Sure. Well, some of them are. but the ones that aren't, the one that you can see now currently streaming on like Amazon, Hulu, Vudu, Amazon, or it's on like 32 streaming platforms, is 100 Acres of Hell, which we're the production company behind that. And that stars WWE superstar Gene Snitsky and Clerks famed Rick Darris, Ernie O'Donnell. And that's out right now. It's a great film for Halloween. And so that's out. Currently we're working on a couple documentaries. One involving the local, police force, especially with the Black Lives Matter stuff. One with drag racing, and the history of that. And one specifically that is one of my favorites, is the future of blues, Clarence Beatty. He has played with everyone from B.B. King to Eric Clapton. He's Grammy nominated. He only lost to B.B. King, which is awesome, but he was a heroin addict for 35, 40 years of his career, and he ended up losing his son last year to an overdose. And so for the last year, he's been clean, and him and I have been working together. He's got, you know, new music coming out, and we're following him along on his journey, and he's going to have a book coming out, and he's got an amazing publicist that I mentioned prior with Matthew Knowles, and I'm not saying again, but so keep an eye out for Clarence Beatty, because he's coming back, man, and he's sober, and he's like better than ever. And, you know, just our stories are so kind of like similar, especially with me losing my husband and being a former addict, and him being an addict and losing his son. And it's awesome to be able to see him and give him a new shot, like at this new life and career that, I mean, he's done everything and everywhere, but this is a whole new everything everywhere, you know?
Well, one thing I was going to mention next, you kind of already mentioned, and being a big wrestling nerd that I am, I need to know, do you have any cool Gene Snitsky stories from being on set with him?
Oh, God. Well, Gene and I have been friends for years. So, like, you know, me and my kids have slept over his house. Like, I mean, okay, here's a fun one. Gene Snitsky he was only allowed to use one toilet in my house when we were filming, because he is a big man and he eats a lot of protein. And though, like, it was like my father, he clogged the toilet that it's like one of those ones on the cruise ship where like when you push it and it's like the lid almost pops off because the suction is so bad. Even with that, Gene Snitsky's shit still got clogged in my house. But my father laughed the whole time because I'm like, Dad, when have you told me, my father always said nobody was going to come and knock on our door, you know, to bring me an opportunity. So I'm like, hey, not only did I bring opportunity here, but, you know, a WWE superstar just, you know, clogged the toilet. Sorry. But when's that going to happen again? But yeah, there's just so many stories, because like I've driven with Gene like long distances, and he always takes over the radio. And then, you know, like, well, I don't know. He's an awesome guy. He's worked me out as like my trainer and stuff a few times, which he kicks my ass, man. But that's why I only do that like twice a year. It's like, and his wife, Carolyn, is absolutely beautiful and wonderful. And I love them both. And they actually invited me over to their house like next week. So, I'll tell them y'all said hi.
Oh my goodness. I just imagine, I want to know so badly, what music does Gene Snitsky put on the radio when he takes it over?
Oh, he's like AC/DC, ZZ Top, Ozzy Osbourne, for sure. Like, he's like, but then, then you know what he'll do? He turns into Xanadu with Olivia Newton-John. He loves Xanadu. He like will sing Xanadu. Like, like, and it's so funny because he'll be like, blah, blah, and then Xanadu. And I'm just like, and he's like, don't touch Olivia Newton-John. You don't turn that off. I'm like, oh, I'm sorry. It's not my fault. You know?
Oh, my. That's what I was hoping for. I'm not going to lie, Stacy. I was like, there's got to be, I hope he has some oddball music choices, because I certainly, looking at Gene Snitsky, would never thought Xanadu.
He's got a collection of heels, too. High-heeled shoes in his size, too. He likes to dress like a woman as well. He's done so on a few occasions in public.
Okay. All right. All right. Well, Stacy, let's plug some of your projects, your website, social media, and everything where folks can keep in touch with you and find out what you got going on.
Okay. You can find us at the number 258studios.com and then all spelled out 258studios on Facebook and on Instagram. And then you can also get me Stacy Toy, StacyToy. Don't forget the E or else my other cousin gets it and I won't get it for 6 months. I'm on Facebook, Instagram, and on LinkedIn. Don't forget the E.
There you go. Stacy, thank you so very much for taking some time out of your day to sit down and chat with me. I really appreciate it.
Oh, I appreciate you, man. Thank you. This was fun.
Excellent. Well, with that, ladies and gentlemen, I'm going to throw it to a quick break. And on the other side of the break, I'll be back to wrap up the episode. Before we move on to my conversation with Richard Bergen, I need to let you know about World's Greatest Comics. They're a great sponsor of the PVD cast, and they're also the place to go if you need anything for your comic book fandom. They've got single issues, collections, graphic novels, toys, collectibles, back issues, posters, and they've got one world-class pull system. So if you're afraid that you might miss a single issue of your favorite comic, sign up for the pull system, and every time that comic comes in, they'll hold a copy for you. So check them out online at wgcomics.com, or you can find them on Facebook. Just search for @WGComics, or better yet, if you're in the Central Ohio area, stop on over to the store. It's located at 5974 Westerville Road in Westerville, Ohio. And let them know that you heard about it from me, John Orlando, right here on the PVD cast. All right, ladies and gentlemen, I am sitting down this evening with Richard Bergen. Richard, how you doing, man?
I'm doing very well, John. Thanks for having me on your show.
Oh, I appreciate you taking some time out of your busy schedule to sit down and chat with us tonight, because you have a really cool project, a movie called Fang. Well, can we maybe start at the beginning? Like,
Sure. Yeah, let's start
over. Where were you born at? Where'd you grow up at?
I grew up in St. Louis. I live in Chicago now. And other than I lived with my mom in Florida for a year and a half, but other than that, I've pretty much lived in the Midwest. So,
okay, all right. You didn't like Florida too well? The heat and the humidity and that?
It was kind of hot, kind of, you know, like where I lived with my mom was like, she lives in a 55 and up community, so there weren't any other people my age around. And it was hot, and it rained all the time in the summer.
Okay, I gotcha. So growing up, what kind of kid were you? Were you always being creative, like writing stories or being involved in art or in acting? What were you, a creative kid?
Oh, absolutely. I would say I was creative generally in a rebellious way. Like, I didn't really... You know, I was not really popular, and, you know, for part of my career at school, I was a good student then, but generally I was not a good student. I was kind of a slacker and rebel, like, but not like a really, you know, like law-breaking rebel, more like a, you know, I'm not going to do this assignment on principle. Get a rebel.
Okay, I gotcha. So you weren't robbing liquor stores.
No,
but you
were
still not doing all your work. I get it.
Yeah, I was cutting corners, kind of a minimalist approach to school.
I gotcha. So after that, you went on to college, and if I remember correctly, you studied film, right?
I did not go to film school, but I did take a class on film when I was in high school.
Okay, that's where I got it. Okay, yeah, okay. Yeah, I knew there was a film class in there.
Somewhere. Yeah, pretty much self-taught as a filmmaker, so it's very kind of... Like, it's always kind of like a trial and error thing where, you know, I'm like, all right, I'm going to do this and I have these ideas and I'm going to go for it. And then I hit a roadblock and I had to figure out how to get around the roadblock so I can create, you know, what the vision I have in my head in real life. So that's what it's all about.
Well, I respect that DIY. I really do. That mindset. I mean, I'm that way. I didn't know how to do podcasts. I mean, so I can totally tip of the hat on that. So obviously, though, if you're into making films, you have to be a film buff, right?
I am. So, I've seen a lot of movies.
What are some of your favorites?
Well, I think that, well, it's kind of funny because it's like when I was a kid, you know, I always liked movies, but I didn't really start to see movies like as an art form until I was a teenager. And the two movies were both horror movies that made me want to be a filmmaker. When I saw Psycho and The Shining for the first time, that changed my whole perspective on what film could be. And then I also saw 2001, A Space Odyssey 2 when I was a kid, a lot younger, but I was too young to really get it. You know, the G rating on that is very... deceptive.
yes it is.
Well, it tricks a lot of parents into thinking it's a kid's movie.
I also think too, you know, when you look at PG in the 70s, PG in the 70s is a little bit rough.
It's, yeah, like Jaws is PG rated.
Yeah exactly.
The first Indiana Jones is PG rated and they have the guy's head gets chopped off.
Is horror your favorite genre of movie to watch?
Well, that's another interesting thing is that I think when horror is done well, it's absolutely my favorite genre to watch, but there are not that many horror movies that meet my personal standards of great horror. So I would say yes and no to that question. I always have a way of making these answers more complicated.
Well, let me ask you. You said that there are certain horror movies that have like this high ranking in your opinion. What are some of those?
Like, well, for me, it always, you know, I think with horror, the problem is that, you know, because it has a lower barrier of entry to make, then you get a lot of people, you know, who are making horror movies who are, you know, not necessarily like the best filmmakers out there because they're just starting out like me. You know, they're figuring out how to do this, but I think horror is at least as difficult to do well as, you know, any other genre of film, you know, because you have to kind of, you know, you have to tell a story while still giving the audience that visceral reaction of, you know, fear and anxiety and creating a great atmosphere where the audience is constantly on edge and in suspense. So I think It really takes a great director to make a great horror movie. And then when you see the great directors who have made horror movies, those are usually the standouts of the genre for me.
I'm gonna go out on a limb. You mentioned The Shining and you mentioned Psycho. So I'm assuming
those are two of my favorites, yeah.
Yeah, I'm assuming you're gonna say that Hitchcock and Kubrick are two top directors
for me. Absolutely.
Okay, so Psycho's the is there any other favorite Hitchcock films? Because I'll share mine, and it's one that not many people really know.
Okay,
have you ever seen I Confess?
I have not seen that one.
I really like that one, Richard. That's one. I mean, that one and Rear Window, they're neck and neck.
Oh wow, yeah, I just saw Rear Window on the big screen like a couple months ago. They're doing a screening at the Music Box Theater here in Chicago. And, you know, I didn't, like it was a lot better than I remembered it seeing it on the big screen. And I kind of forgot how much of Rear Window, you know, was kind of a comedy. Like the interaction between the characters is very funny as everybody kind of gets sucked into Jimmy Stewart's web of madness.
Yeah. Yeah. I will say that I confess, not a horror movie, but very suspenseful. I recommend it a lot. It was very, very, very good.
That's good. No, I'll definitely check it out. And I guess my other two favorite Hitchcock movies besides Psycho would be Vertigo and The Birds. So that kind of, that 5-year stretch was really a dynamite period. Yes. He made all those movies like in just 5 years.
Yeah. Yeah. Have you just deviating real quick, deviating from where I was going. Did you see the Anthony Hopkins biopic of Hitchcock?
I did. Yeah, that was good.
What'd you think of it? You liked it?
I thought it did a good job playing Hitchcock. And yeah, I mean, of course, it doesn't like give you the whole, you know, story of his life, but I think they did a good job dramatizing the making of Psycho. And probably Anthony Hopkins is the only actor who could have played Hitchcock.
Yeah,
they could have this. They look a lot alike, you know, at least at that age.
Yeah, I liked it a lot too. So I was just curious what you thought of it. I dug it because I thought it was a really good. Again, like you said, it's just looking at a small section of Hitchcock's life, and I think that was a smart way to go. You're producing that film.
Yeah, you can never tell like the whole story of somebody's life in 2 hours. It doesn't really work like most regular movies, you know, don't try to do that. Like it would be really weird as a screenwriter if I started out the opening scene of like showing the main character at birth and showing them elementary school, middle school, high school before we get to the main plot.
Well, let's talk a little bit about Fang. Describe the plot of the film to the listeners?
Yes, Fang is the story of a young janitor named Billy Cochran who has undiagnosed autism, and he lives with his mother, Gina, in this kind of gritty neighborhood in Chicago. So Billy is very kind of isolated. He's detached from the people around him. And one night, you know, Billy wakes up. He has to go to the bathroom. And then when he goes in there, there's this rat in the bathtub. And then the rat jumps out, chases him around, you know, the living room. Then the rat bites him. And so from there, Billy starts to feel like he's transforming into a giant rat himself. And I can't say anything else that happens because that would give away too much of the story.
So what was the catalyst for you writing this tale? Like what caused you to sit down, you know, one day and go, I got this idea and I'm going to write it?
Well, a lot of the movie was inspired by different life experiences that I've had. I've never felt like I was turning into a rat. Thankfully, not yet anyway. But a lot of it was inspired by, you know, my relationship with my dad and inspired Billy's relationship with his mother in Fang. And I have high-functioning Asperger, so that inspired the character of Billy having autism, although he's much more severe than me. He's very kind of, you know, I'm a lot more self-aware than he is. He's only starting to gain awareness that something is, you know, wrong with his environment and, you know, his place in the world.
Was it difficult to write some of that? I mean, you know, everybody has things they know about themselves or aware of it, but yet sharing that with people is sometimes very, very tough. Was that hard for you, or did you have kind of an idea that, well, this is what I want to say, and it's, you know, just kind of flows out on the page?
Well, I would say, like, from a pragmatic standpoint, it was easier to write because I knew how these characters interact with each other because they're based on people I know.
Okay.
So in that sense, it was easier to write because I'm like, oh, I know what they're going to say in this scene.
Okay, I
gotcha. I've literally said these things and had these things said to me. And emotionally, it was a little bit challenging at times, although I had already kind of you know, when I was at college before I made this movie, I'd already kind of done a lot of soul searching back then. So I would say probably the more emotionally intense years were before I even started writing Fang. And it was only after I had already been through that, that I started to write the script for this movie.
So where did you shoot this film at? Predominantly throughout the Chicago area?
Yeah, we did. We filmed in Chicago in January and February. So filming outside was a little bit chilly sometimes. But we actually, it turned out to be incredibly good timing because a month after we finished filming, then the shutdown happened. So if I had listened to everybody who told me to wait until it was warmer to make the movie, I would have been screwed.
So, well, let me just ask, was being in lockdown, did that help you kind of get through the movie and get it all polished and get it edited and everything? Because I, you know, I've talked to some other people, other creators who said, well, you know what, one nice part about lockdown was I got a lot of projects done and I got things finished on time and whatnot. Was that the case for you?
Not really. I would say that I've had a number of other issues that I've had to deal with during the lockdown because, okay, you know, when you have like kind of unstable mental health, that tends to get worse when you're suddenly cut off from like the normal things you could otherwise do. But we have been chugging along, and we haven't had any major delays in post-production. The main source of delays was me being overly ambitious in terms of the time frame we could get things done. Like, I remember right when we were done filming, I'm like, hey, we can have the whole movie finished by the end of June. And then my producer was like, no, we can't. So, and so we're, as of now, we're aiming to have an online premiere for Fang in November. And then after that, we're going to get a distribution deal, and it'll get a wider release to people probably sometime in 2021. And our top contenders for distributing Fang would be Netflix and Amazon Prime, because they have the widest reach, mm-hmm, for, you know, streaming. And I would, mm-hmm, like to get it in theaters too, but I know that's very unlikely in this day and age. Even before the shutdown, you know, there weren't that many movies still getting a theatrical release. It's become very dominated by just like a few blockbuster franchises. So I would like it to get a theatrical release, but, you know, I'll settle for a good streaming deal that, you know, gets it into the homes of many people so they can all have the Fang experience on their own time.
You know, you talked about one of your producers, and I wanted to just add a few notes down here to talk about some of the crew. Can you talk a little bit about how you managed to meet up and maybe work with Jason Krainick, who was, if I remember correctly, the director of photography?
Yeah, well, the story of how I met Jason was pretty simple. You know, after I finished writing the script for Fang, I was like, well, all right, well, now I need somebody to be cinematographer and I need somebody to be producer. So I Googled, you know, cinematographers in Chicago and just typed it out. And Jason's name came up, and then I looked at his website and I really liked, you know, what I saw on there. He had some really great shots, and it looked like kind of the right look for Fang that I had pictured in my head. So that I sent Jason an email saying, hey, you know, I have this movie I want to make, you know, do you want to get on board? And then I sent him the script, you know, he really liked the script. And then he brought his friend, our producer, Robert Felker, on board. And then from there, we got the whole production set up. So it was pretty straightforward.
Well, I want to give a tip of the hat because, you know, while doing some research on the Facebook page for Fang, there's a lot of shots, and some of those shots are really, really primo. They are fantastic. Yeah, Jason did a great job. I mean, it's really, really good. And we'll talk about.
We had some gorgeous cinematography in there, and it's going to even look even better when we're done color grading, when we get through that final stage of post-production. So you've just seen like the rough draft so far.
Yeah, but he did a great job. Let's talk about the actors. You got Dylan Larrey, Lynn Lowry, Jess Paul. So can you talk a little bit about how you managed to cast those folks in their respective roles?
Oh, yeah. Well, for Dylan's role, and he plays Billy, the main character, and what I did for casting that role is I just put out an audition notice on backstage.com, and so I watched a bunch of different audition videos that different actors sent in, and what really stood out to me about Dylan's audition video is that he really captured the nonverbal aspects of Billy's character. You know, because a lot of actors, when they audition, you know, they want to show that they're acting. They want to do the monologue. They want to show the big emotions and gestures. But Dylan had really good facial expressions and movements. And because a lot of Fang is like Billy is not the most talkative guy. He's generally pretty quiet. While the other characters usually dominate their scenes with him, so having really good facial expressions and movements was ultimately why Dylan's audition stuck with me the most and why I gave him the role. For Lynn, it's interesting, but she's the most famous actor that we have in the movie, though Lynn has 50 years of experience doing these kinds of independent horror movies. She worked with Cronenberg and Romero back in the 70s.
Wow. Yeah. Wow. Okay.
Yeah, she has a long, she's done some really great work over the years. So she actually messaged me when she saw, like, I had mentioned something on Facebook about, you know, I'm making a movie. And then she was like, well, I hope you would consider working with me. And I'm like, hell yeah, I'd consider working with you. And so that's how she got the role.
Okay, yeah. That, you didn't have to get your arm twisted on that one, right?
No.
So what about Jess? What about Jess Paul? How did you come across Jess?
Well, she also messaged me, too. I remember that was also through Facebook. I was one of those days where I was just kind of going through, like, friend requesting different people. It looked like we had some mutual friends. And then Jess messaged me and said, I noticed you friend request me. Why did you friend request me? Are you in the film industry? And then I said, yes, I'm just trying to meet, you know, new people. So we got to talking about our different, you know, projects and careers. And then so then I told her about Fang, and Jess said, you know, well, I would be interested in that. That sounds like a really cool, you know, project. So then I sent her the script when I was done writing it, and then she loved the script, and then she was very, you know, very on board with playing her character, Myra, who is the caregiver to Billy's mother, Gina.
Well, as we have just a couple more questions here for you, Richard, what advice would you give somebody that wanted to make their own movie?
Well, I would say if you're making a movie independently, you gotta write it so it can be made as cheaply as possible when you're starting out, because the more expensive a movie is to make, the less likely it's going to get made. I think, you know, when you look at different screenwriters, they make the mistake of thinking that, oh, if I write this kind of epic blockbuster, you know, that's what Hollywood wants, and that's what's going to get made, but they're not going to make your epic blockbuster script because it's all unknown intellectual property. They're only going to make your script if it could be done on a very low budget, if they don't know who you are, or, you know, you don't have a huge track record of success already. So I would say that would be my number one point of advice, would be, you know, aim for the lowest possible budget for your project. And my other point of advice would be, you know, give it time. Like, it's not going to happen overnight. It's going to take years before you get to make your first feature film. So don't give up if you don't get instant success.
Okay. Do you have any future movie plans? Like, have you started thinking about the next film, or are you just
I do,
totally
yeah.
focused? Okay.
I'm a big planner. I have like a bunch of different ideas for movies that are in varying stages of development. I do have one screenplay that I'm almost finished for revising. I like to joke that I've been almost finished revising it for several months now, but now I'm actually getting closer to the end. The title is Broken Angels. It's a thriller. It's about like a very charismatic politician who is campaigning to be elected senator of Florida. And he's very, you know, he's very good at saying the right thing. He's very good at manipulating people to do what he wants. But he has a double life where he's kind of this violent, sociopathic predator. So it's all about like the protagonist trying to bring him to justice and uncovering all of this really twisted stuff about him that he keeps hidden from the public eye. And that's basically the premise of that script.
That sounds a little nonfiction, if you ask me. No, I'm just kidding. I'm kidding. We're not.
The world around you, you know, that's there. There's a lot of inspiration everywhere.
All right. Before we plug social media and on website and all that stuff, Richard, on your Facebook, you have a quote, and your quote says, "You are somewhere between creative visionary and insane."
Well, it depends on what mood I'm in.
Okay, I was gonna say, why do you think that fits you so well?
Well, I think that, you know, I'm always somebody, you know, I think when I was younger, you know, I was rebellious, but I wasn't quite as rebellious as I am today. So there was still a part of me that was like, all right, you know, I got to get good grades so I can get into college and get a good job and have like a backup plan in case I don't actually get to become a filmmaker. But then, you know, when I was at college, I got very depressed, you know, because everything was so kind of structured and rule oriented. I felt like I was in this little box. So at a certain point, you know, I realized, you know, I'm not going to do the logical thing. I'm going to follow my instincts. And if my instincts tell me something, that it's probably correct, even if I don't understand why yet. And so sometimes my instincts, you know, tell me to make Fang, and other times my instincts can get me into trouble. So it all depends. So I think that's why I'm on the border between, I guess, creative visionary and insane. It all depends on what kind of day I'm having.
All right. Well, I enjoyed that. I thought that was a pretty unique way to describe yourself. And
thank you.
Yeah, I mean, we all have those days where we have the devil and the angel on each shoulder, you know?
I think I have like probably two devils and one angel.
All right, well, Richard, where can folks keep tabs on Fang, find out more about you, et cetera, et cetera? So you got some social media outlets to plug or websites or whatever.
Well, the best resource as of now to find out more about Fang is the Fang the Movie page, which I saw you were referring to some of the pictures from there. Yeah. But we do have a lot of gorgeous pictures from Fang on that page, and a lot of, you know, interesting testimonials from different people, including me, you know, writing about different aspects of the Fang experience. And I do plan on getting a website soon, but I have so many different projects going on at the moment that that's kind of on the back burner for now. But I'm almost ready to get my website up and running.
So Facebook, just it's at Fang the Movie, or?
Fang the Movie, that's the name of our Facebook page. Okay. Yeah.
Okay. People should go check it out. You know, again, one of the other things, real quickly, if I may, just before we wrap things up.
Yeah, sure.
I did really like, I don't know how to define it, but I liked the honesty of a lot of your posts. You know, I kind of went through and, you know, there were times I think where you had mentioned, you know, things maybe didn't go as smoothly as you'd hoped that day for shooting, or you'd worked so long and you ended up, I think one time you wrapped a little early and the rest of the crew was so dedicated that they continued to work and kind of get things set up for you. And I think that to me, that resonated with me because you're not trying to fool people into thinking, oh, this is easy. you know, it's hard. Yeah, yeah. So, that was awesome. So,
Thank you, John. Well, I always try to be, you know, as honest as possible, you know, in my personal life and as an artist, you know, because I think that, you know, the best movies are always, you know, honest on some level, even if, you know, they're fictional, but they're honest about human nature. They're honest about the way the world is, even if they use like a fantasy world as a way to describe our world. But I think that, in order to be really good at what you do, you have to be honest with how you go about it. You can't be doing it just to impress people, because then it's going to be shallow and kind of lame.
Well, there you go. And again, folks, I urge you to check it out over on Facebook. Just search for it, Fang the Movie. Richard, thank you very much, man, for sitting down and chatting with me.
Thank you, John. Yeah, this has been a great show. I've had a great time talking with you.
Thanks. And with that, ladies and gentlemen, I'm going to take a quick break. And on the other side of the break, I'll be back to wrap up the episode. Well, there you have it, ladies and gentlemen. My conversations with Stacy Toy and Richard Bergen. And I hope that you enjoyed those conversations. And I will say it one more time. I appreciate Richard and Stacy taking some time out of their busy schedules to sit down and talk here on the PVD cast. So it's about that time for me to let you know where you can get in touch with me if you need to do so. You could shoot me an email. My email address is johnorlando@pvdcast.com. You can leave me a message on the Facebook page and the Instagram feed of this podcast. Just look for @PVDcast. And you can find me on Twitter. My personal Twitter handle is @PVDMVP. And you can get the PVDcast basically anywhere where you find podcasts, such as Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher Radio, Deezer, etc., etc. Or you could swing on past PVDcast.com, the online home of yours truly, and you can listen to it there. But no matter where you listen or how you listen, I'm going to ask you to please rate and review, because that helps me out in the algorithm. And don't forget to subscribe so you never miss an episode of the PVD cast. And you know what? Make sure you tell some folks about it, because word of mouth is the best advertising around, and I would really, really appreciate it if you did. So with that being said, ladies and gentlemen, I'm going to get on out of here. Thanks for listening, and I will chat at each and every one of you later. Stay righteous, stay independent, and stay safe and healthy. Has been a production of John Orlando Enterprises, LLC, copyright 2019.